English. Gada is way ahead. His children are learning quickly at school.
What has been the worst thing you have found in America?
L'ora l'inglese.
The English language.
This church meeting is Osama's way to connect with a wider congregation to tell them who he is. He says through a translator, I owned a small factory in Syria. I provided for my family. His face, scarred by a blinding artillery attack, tells the story of war and loss. He has one more message. Osama insists on telling a joke, and he's worked it out with Tom Charles.
And Osama, can you tell us the joke about Tarzan's last words?
Tarzan's last famous words were, who put grease on the vine?
With this simple joke, Osama has made a larger point. I'm not so different from you. But American culture is very different from what the family expected. For example, this is their first Halloween.
We just said it's fun. It's about collecting candy and dressing up. I think it was pretty strange for them.
What?
On an afternoon in late October, Sue Jennings, part of the Nassau Church team, delivers donated costumes and some guidance.
A jack-o'-lantern is a pumpkin with a face.
The kids are already elbow deep in orange goo.
Do you have Halloween in Syria?
Never in Syria, no.
No, in Jordan, no. In Syria, no. Every Arabic, no.
They know about pumpkins, part of a savory Syrian stew. Their father, Osama, asks, why is there an American holiday that wastes so much food? He's been the most anxious about Halloween. Does it conflict with his Muslim faith? But he gets caught up in his children's excitement about an upcoming parade at school.
Mama, that's it, and Mickey Mouse?
He can't see the costumes, but he insists on approving the choices. Nothing scary, no black magic. He vetoes Harry Potter. But he's okay with Disney for the girls and Superman for the boys.
Superman.
A Superman.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes, Superman.
Yes, Superman.
At school, the four Syrian kids walk the Halloween parade route with their classmates, now part of the community that welcomed their arrival, the new start made possible by generous church support. This is one part of America, but another part emerges after the presidential elections that seemed to signal there could be a harsher response to their presence here.
Okay, this is a new, something new.
Osama stayed up late, following election returns. The next morning, he and Gada have an English lesson with Beverly Leach and a church interpreter.
12 o'clock to 7 o'clock in the morning.
Oh.
Yes. Osama stayed up all night?
He stayed up all night because the whole world is affected by elections.
Yes.
He wants to know, do we have to go back? Could the new American president ban head coverings for Muslim women?
You are here, and you can stay here, no problems. You are
on this morning, here. Beverly Leach assures him that nothing will change. We support you, and we have welcomed you. But he continues to ask questions days after the vote.
Okay, listening there to my colleague Deb Amos following the story of the Syrian refugee family. And Deb, Osama, the father, clearly anxious, wondering what this election means. What about the church group that helped them? How are they responding to the election?
Yeah, I talked to Dave Davis. He's the pastor at Nassau Presbyterian. And he said there were anxious calls that came the morning after that vote.
Some of the first conversations I had were with the volunteers who've spent so much time with the family, wanting to be assured that they could be supporting and let the family know we're there and that we're surrounding them. That type of fear for the family and the family sense of fear is exactly the type of anxiety that was percolating in the hours and the days after the election.
That's Pastor Dave Davis. The family and the church is worried about the political atmosphere, but they've got more practical challenges. Osama is just starting at the vocational center. Gada has to learn more English to learn how to drive. And like most refugees, there's medical catch-up. Especially, there's a lot of dental appointments for the kids. The church support group says this resettlement is taking more time, and it may run past the one-year commitment for this intense support.
Okay, that's my colleague NPR's Deb Amos following the story of one Syrian refugee family in New Jersey. Deb, thanks.
Thank you.
President-elect Trump has made a provocative choice for Secretary of Education. Betsy DeVos comes from a wealthy Michigan family. She's a Republican activist and philanthropist. She's been deeply engaged in education for many years with a complex record that has already triggered lively debates on the left and the right. She's an advocate for school choice. That phrase means, in essence, directing public education money to charter schools, private schools, or parochial schools. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
In the news release touting his pick for Secretary of Education, Donald Trump said this about Betsy DeVos. Quote, under her leadership, we can deliver a world-class education and school choice to all families. End of quote. DeVos's statement turned a well-known Trump slogan and proclaimed, we will make American education great again. Proponents of school choice were ecstatic, including Sandy Kress, a top education advisor in George W. Bush's administration.
I thought that's who the pick would be all along. She always made the most sense to me.
Kress says DeVos's record on school choice in Michigan sealed the deal. That's why Trump picked her. But putting $20 billion federal dollars into school choice, like Trump promised during his campaign?
Probably not. But by picking her, it is a way of his saying, I'm picking somebody who's been very active in this for a long time, and she reflects my view.
DeVos got a big thumbs up from the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. Even Jeb Bush, who had some pretty nasty spats with Donald Trump during the Republican primaries, congratulated DeVos, calling her an outstanding pick. By the way, she's on the board of Bush's Foundation for Excellence in Education. For the nation's two biggest teachers' unions, DeVos's nomination is terrible news.
My gut reaction was, oh my God, we are now back into the education wars.
Randy Weingarten, head of the American Federation of Teachers, calls DeVos the most ideological anti-public education nominee since the creation of the U.S. Department of Education nearly 40 years ago. Lily Eskelson-Garcia, head of the National Education Association, agrees.
There is no more staunch advocate for taking public dollars and giving them to private schools that can pick the students they want to teach, than Betsy DeVos.
Finally, there's the Common Core standards. Donald Trump hates the Common Core, created by governors and state education commissioners and initially adopted by 45 states. DeVos has actually supported the Common Core until now. Shortly after her nomination was announced, DeVos tweeted almost as if she had forgotten something important to say. And she said, I am not a supporter of the Common Core. Sandy Kress predicts that debate will die down soon enough.
And then they're going to spend most of their time promoting choice.
And that will be DeVos's marching orders from day one. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
18 minutes after 8, you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks for joining us. News headlines coming up next. And later this morning, highlights from the Wisconsin School Music Association Honors Concerts. Performances by middle and high school orchestras and choirs. You can hear that as part of morning classical music between 10 and noon today.
Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home, encouraging your awareness of the Kenosha Symphony's holiday concert at Reuther High School on Saturday, December 10th. Enjoy several fantasias on carols and the Kenosha Chamber Choir. More information at kenoshasymphony.org.
Says run December 1st through the 11th. WPR is proud to promote live theater performance. For more information, go to wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A truck bombing in Iraq today has killed at least 21 people. Many more were wounded. The explosion went off at a gas station south of Baghdad near the city of Hilla. So far, there's been no claim of responsibility. Some reports put the death toll much higher. An explosion in southeast Turkey today has killed at least 2 people and wounded more than 30 others. NPR's Peter Kenyon says the governor's office is calling it a terror attack.
Officials believe the bomb was planted in a vehicle left near the governor's office in the city of Adana. The district governor issued a statement on the preliminary casualty reports. Ambulances moved to the scene to evacuate the wounded. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. Adana is home to Incirlik Air Base, used by American and other NATO forces.
Police there say they later shot and captured a suspect in the bombing. Authorities in West Virginia say they're investigating the fatal shooting of a 15-year-old as a potential federal hate crime. Police say 62-year-old William Pulliam confessed to the shooting, but he denies race played a role. Pulliam is white. The teenager was black. Pulliam says he felt threatened by the teen after they bumped into each other in Charleston.
If they charge me with a hate crime, they can, but they got to prove that I hate black people. And I don't.
Pulliam is charged with murder. There's no trading today on Wall Street because of Thanksgiving. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
And with Wisconsin Public Radio News, I'm Peter Bryant. More big retailers are closed for Thanksgiving today. But as Danielle Kading reports, a national retail group says 2 million more people are set to shop this holiday weekend.
National Retail Federation spokeswoman Anna Serafin-Smith says roughly 137 million people are either considering or planning to shop this weekend. She says about 21% are thinking about cashing in on deals today, despite the closure of more than 50 major retailers.
But very different now compared to the past is that although their stores are closed, their websites are open. So a lot of these retailers, their websites will be running Thanksgiving Day promotions. And so you could still shop at your favorite retail store, but you could do it from the comfort of your sofa right after you enjoyed a delicious Thanksgiving meal.
The majority of shoppers surveyed by the National Retail Federation say they may take advantage of deals on Black Friday. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Madison City Council has approved investing $4.4 million in four affordable housing projects. The Wisconsin State Journal reports the decision continues an effort to create 1,000 lower-cost units over 5 years. The affordable housing plan, approved by Mayor Soglin 2 years ago, aims to build 250 housing units with support services for the homeless. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Office locations are at visitingangels.com. From Encore.org, presenting Generation to Generation, a campaign aimed at mobilizing 1 million adults over 50 to help young people thrive and uniting all ages to create a better future. Learn more at generationtogeneration.org. From American Express, offering charge and credit cards to help business owners cover the big purchases they need to make when they need to make them. More about American Express business cards and services can be found at open.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green with the story of an unexpected side effect. Laws are designed to prevent elephant poaching in Africa. They ban selling elephant ivory, and they're having an effect in Alaska. Turns out the federal and state bans on elephant ivory are also damaging the market for walrus ivory, which is not illegal. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, hunters and artists expect sales to drop even lower.
Among the dozens of tables at a recent craft fair in Fairbanks, the glitter and gleam of Dennis Pungawi's ivory stands out. He's got everything from small sculptures of birds to curved cribbage boards etched into tusks.
I'm more well known for my walruses, though. These bigger ones are from a 10-pound tusk, and I only get maybe two or three of those tusks a year.
Walruses are not an endangered species, and under federal rules, Alaskan natives are entitled to hunt them and sell stuff like whiskers, bones, and ivory. Pungawi's family is from Savunga, a community of about 700 people on St. Lawrence Island in between Alaska and Russia. The primary reason for the hunt is food, but the sale of tusks and carvings helps bring in cash.
We've taken a pretty big hit on this elephant ivory ban. People are getting mistaken with it, with walrus ivory, because they're not explaining and getting it out there.
Since the summer, Pungawi says federal and state regulations cracking down on the domestic market for elephant ivory have caused people to think all ivory is illegal.
I'm down probably a good 40%. This show here is what I'm banking on to help get me through the winter.
Ivory isn't controversial here. It's common as jewelry or decoration in homes. People know it comes from locally hunted walruses. But carvers depend on tourists and art dealers from the lower 48 buying goods. Melanie Banky is president of a nonprofit in the Bering Strait region where a lot of residents pay for essential goods like clothing and heating oil with ivory sails. She arranged a craft fair this summer when a luxury cruise ship docked in Nome, but nobody bought anything.
Once they realized that something was made out of ivory, you could tell that there was almost a disdain, a look of disdain.
And tightening state regulations in California, Hawaii, New York, and New Jersey mean a drop in demand. Banky says Alaska ivory isn't making it to market, an effect she and others worry could be devastating to rural communities like Savunga.
It can be a huge part of a family's income, whether it's an $80 carving or an $8,000 carving. When our communities are already living below poverty, that's a big source of income for our people.
I think most people have tried to make it pretty specific to elephant ivory, but I think the messaging has maybe been conflated.
Ellie Pepper works for the Natural Resources Defense Council and helped lobby state legislatures on their recent ivory bans. When I asked if it was possible to stamp out demand for elephant products without harming the livelihoods of walrus hunters in Alaska, she said it's tricky.
We respect the rights of Native Alaskans to use wildlife for subsistence purposes. And, you know, these bills were not intended to obstruct that.
There's no quick and accurate scientific test to distinguish elephant from walrus ivory. And even if there were, many in Alaska are scared it may be too late to undo misperceptions. At his craft fair table in Fairbanks, Dennis Pungawi says it's a tragedy that conservation of elephants is jeopardizing the tradition and livelihoods of Alaskan natives.
The locals, Alaskans, they know that it's legal, but it's just a horrible, horrible thing.
Pungawi says now he'll have to focus more on private commissions to make a living. For NPR News, I'm Zachariah Hughes in Fairbanks.
Some people are struggling in the U.S. economy. That was said to be one message of this year's election. But other people are doing very well indeed, and that's reflected in the market for SUVs. In this time of cheap gas, sport utility vehicles and trucks make up 60% of the new vehicle market, and high-end companies are getting into the game now. Brands like Maserati, Jaguar, and even Lamborghini. NPR's Sonari Glinton reports.
I drive a lot of cars, and it can be a lot of fun, but then sometimes, you know, you need another point of view. So I wanted to get help from a pedestrian. Actually, no one would call her a pedestrian. She's NPR's White House correspondent, Tamara Keith, who's going to describe this SUV for me.
Pedestrian?
Pedestrian. You're standing on the street, right?
Yeah, I am standing on the street. Okay, it's definitely elevated off the ground. The top is cut off. It's a convertible. It looks like fun. It looks like it's going to be wind in the hair. There doesn't appear to be much of a trunk. The top is taking up most of the storage space.
So it's an SUV with not a lot of utility.
Right. I mean, unless the utility is driving over rocks or something, in which case it looks like it could maybe do that.
But I don't think that a lot of people are going to be spending $70,000 to drive a Range Rover Evoque over any rock.
Okay, so then what's the point?
Well, I asked Mark Takahashi, who's with Edmunds.com, that exact question right before I came over to pick you up, and here's his answer. So who is this car for?
Let's say fashion-conscious urbanites who have the idea that they'll go out and explore the world.
Takahashi says luxury brands were slow to get on the SUV bandwagon, so think performance cars such as Lamborghini or luxury cars like Bentley.
A lot of manufacturers have said, we need to get more SUVs because that's what's selling, that's what people want. Let's make something that's a little more appealing to the city people.
Gas prices and fuel economy rules have led consumers in all categories to go large. Rebecca Lindland with Kelley Blue Book says Porsche is a good example.
The majority of Porsche 911 owners in the U.S. also had an SUV in their garage, and the Cayenne let them have a two Porsche garage.
Porsche's number one car is an SUV, the Macan. Its number two car, also an SUV, the Cayenne. Lindland says other manufacturers have been watching.
When you look at the price points that it commands on a fully loaded Cayenne, you're talking $120,000, $150,000 and up for Porsche. I think some of these manufacturers looked and said, you know, there's money to be made in that game.
Another reason for the current prevalence of luxury SUVs might not be that obvious. China.
Maserati's selling very well in the U.S., but the number one market right now for the Maserati Levante SUV is in China.
Reed Bigland runs Maserati for the Fiat Chrysler Group.
The Chinese are gobbling up SUVs like they're going out of style. This is also looking to expand the brand, because the reality is consumers are moving away from passenger cars. They're moving towards SUVs.
Yeah, they're probably going to have to start calling me the SUV reporter. Sonari Glenton, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On Thanksgiving, we return to a musical tradition, a chain of gratitude linking one artist to another.
She was all that and more, and since then has been.
I just knew there was something huge going on there.
She's become a really inspiring storyteller and singer.
It's a timeless, incredible thing that I'm forever grateful for.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Music to be thankful for, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in for that story and much more, including the day's news. All Things Considered comes your way today and every weekday from 4 until 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Time now, 8:30. Good morning and happy Thanksgiving. Glad you're with us. I'm Peter Bryant in for Maureen McCollum today. Be sure to join us for some special programming, too, coming up later, including highlights from the Wisconsin School Music Association Honors Concerts, that between 10 and noon today, and then a Thanksgiving special called Giving Thanks, a celebration of fall, food, and gratitude. Plenty of good music in that, too, starting at 1. In Wisconsin news this morning, more than 1 million Wisconsinites will be driving this Thanksgiving holiday. Avery Brookins reports.
Almost 2% more cars will be on the roads this year compared to last year. AAA Wisconsin's Director of Public Affairs, Nick Jarmis, says the number of people traveling ticked up each of the last 8 years because of an improving economy.
Folks are feeling a little bit more confident about their income, about their employment security, and they're willing to spend the money that's necessary to travel, to either visit family or even to just utilize this long weekend for some leisure travel.
The average price of gas in Wisconsin is around $2, which is about 25 cents less than last year. Gas prices also went down a similar amount from 2014 to 2015. Avery Brookins, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And more headlines, including NPR News, coming up in 10 minutes.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from many small businesses. This Saturday is Small Business Saturday, a day that encourages shopping and dining at local businesses. WPR is proud of the support we receive from small businesses across the state.
Support for WGTD comes from Andrea's in Kenosha, welcoming author Michael Schumacher Saturday, November 26th from 1 to 3 p.m., signing his newest book, Torn in Two: The Sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and One Man's Survival on the Open Sea.
The weather forecast, cloudy, with high temperatures in the mid-30s to around 40. Some light freezing drizzle, looks like light snow possible, too, in northwest and northeast Wisconsin today. For tonight and tomorrow, another round of some light snow possible in many parts of the state. Lows tonight in the 20s, highs tomorrow in the mid to upper 30s. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from MailChimp, providing email, analytics, and digital tools for helping people grow their businesses on their terms. MailChimp, being yourself, makes all the difference. From American Express, offering charge and credit cards to help business owners cover the big purchases they need to make when they need to make them. More about American Express business cards and services can be found at open.com. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Our next guest has been closely watching Vladimir Putin for years. He even went to war with him once. It's Mikhail Saakashvili, the former president of Georgia. We turn to him for some insight into what Russia's leader might be up to and also how Putin might deal with Donald Trump. Saakashvili first met Putin when he took power in Georgia in 2004. He says his Russian counterpart offered some advice.
From the very beginning, the first thing he told me that he really doesn't appreciate people who would be too subservient to the United States.
In fact, Saakashvili brought Georgia closer to the United States. Georgia even applied for membership in NATO, which ticked off Putin a lot. In 2008, Saakashvili says Russian tanks amassed on the Georgian border, and he asked the U.S. for help.
We told, look, here are the combat-ready tanks, and, you know, please do something about it. And then they got back to us and said, no, no, we don't think it's serious. We don't think that it's going to happen. And then when the whole thing started, within hours, those tanks were there, just exactly as we had warned.
Now, of course, the reality is that Georgia fired the first shot, but then Georgia was overwhelmed. Russia carried out a short punitive invasion. And after that, Saakashvili says he was not surprised to see Putin go after the Crimean Peninsula in Ukraine next.
People in the West thought that we were just, you know, delusional. We were just saying things because we were bitter. But when Crimea happened, the reaction from the West was to the Ukrainians, guys, don't do anything. Don't provoke them further. Don't move your finger. So the annexation happened without almost a single shot fired.
Now, Saakashvili is known for being blunt. His critics have called him erratic. He can use colorful language, and he does so in this interview. He tells us that Putin is much more methodical in his foreign policy tactics than he's given credit for.
He clearly is a very rational person. I mean, he sometimes plays a madman, but even his madness is quite rational, because when he plays madman, he says, look, don't mess with me because I'm mad.
His madness is calculated, is what you're saying.
Yes. He kind of gets emboldened by the fact that, you know, he says things and people seem to accept them, then he starts to do things.
So what does the West do now? I mean, you have the Baltic countries like Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia,
yes.
These NATO countries right on Russia's border. I mean, there have been these events like Russia coming across, Estonia says, and taking an Estonian spy. I mean, is Putin, what's he doing? Is he sort of testing this response? Does he have plans in countries like that?
Remember, ultimately, he's after the United States.
He's after the United States.
The day one when I saw him, I understood that this guy is only just positioning himself, that he's trying to reverse all the gains the U.S. has got in the aftermath of the Cold War. So, for instance, when President Obama said after Ukraine, well, yeah, they messed up in Ukraine, but, you know, Russia, after all, is a regional power. They don't really create problems anywhere else because, you know, they just will be with their region. Immediately after that, Putin went to Syria. And I think in many ways it was a reaction to Americans saying, well, he's just a regional power, to prove that he can be very efficient in the battlefields where Americans are also present. And with Baltic countries, it's the same scenario.
Well, Mr. Saakashvili, you say that Putin is a risk assessor.
Sure.
Do you really think he would attack a NATO country if he knows the response that might provoke? Does he really want to take the risk of a larger conflict with the West?
You are totally right, if he thinks that there will be a big reaction. But if he thinks that there won't be that big reaction, certainly he will take his chances.
Well, so much might depend on his relationship with Donald Trump. And let me move to that, because if Trump is able to open a dialogue with Vladimir Putin, as he has suggested, and he makes it clear to Vladimir Putin that there will be a response from the United States were he to attack a NATO country, could that be enough for Putin to say, this is too big a risk, I'm not going to do that?
Trump, I don't think he will allow anybody, not least the Putin, to dominate him. One of the main things that Putin had been doing was intimidating them, dominating them. That's his usual trick with foreign leaders. I don't think it's going to work with Trump.
Sounds like you're optimistic that Donald Trump could contain Vladimir Putin.
Look, it's still early to say. It depends who the Secretary of State will be. It depends how much interest the president will take of foreign policy.
I want to ask you about some of the personal back and forth with Vladimir Putin. He at one point, I'm not sure how to put this, said that he wished that you would be hung by your private parts.
He pledged publicly that he would hang me by my balls. Yes, he likes to say such things, and we better take him at his word. But I guess he had other things to do for all this time to say those things.
Putin is seen as kind of a macho guy. Is there a risk if Donald Trump gets into kind of a verbal tit-for-tat like that?
Look, I mean, he had also personal problems with President Obama. And I think Donald Trump is very different. I think he has a very strong personality. He's still very unpredictable, very, very unpredictable. I don't know what his exact foreign policy might look like in this region. But certainly he's very detail-oriented and he likes results. And I don't think he would give in so easily.
All right, Mr. Saakashvili, real pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for calling me. Bye-bye.
That was Mikhail Saakashvili, the former president of Georgia. He joined us on Skype from Ukraine.
Well, this morning, the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade is bringing back an old friend.
Felix the cat, the wonderful, wonderful cat. Whenever he gets in a fix, he reaches into his bag of tricks.
That's right. After 85 years, the Felix the Cat balloon is making a comeback. In the 1920s, Felix was a huge star in comics and animated movies. He joined the Macy's Parade in 1927 as the very first character balloon.
He was paraded down on stilts because he only contained air, oxygen, not helium. that came later.
That's Steven Silverman, author of Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, a New York City holiday tradition. Silverman says Felix's joy was short-lived. 1 year later, he would be upstaged by a big-eared rival.
And now they're all waiting for Mickey himself. Here he comes.
Yes, Mickey Mouse. In 1928, Mickey was the star of Steamboat Willie, the very first talking cartoon.
Oh, my goodness. This is like Sunset Boulevard or something, because Felix was a star of the silent movie era. And like many of the stars from that era, gradually began to see their fame go away.
He hung on for a very long time. And, you know, he wasn't replaced by Mickey Mouse at all. Mickey was added. There was no conspiracy to get rid of Felix the Cat.
Just a loss of interest, and by 1931, he was out. Steven Silverman says Macy's decision to bring Felix back now for the 90th parade was the right thing to do.
I think Felix will have a noticeable presence. A star is a star is a star. You know, he may not be Pokemon, but Felix is a credible celebrity.
A celebrity whose star is back on the rise this Thanksgiving Day with help from some helium.
Felix the Cat, the wonderful, wonderful cat. Whenever he gets in a fix, he reaches into his bag of tricks. Felix the Cat, the wonderful, wonderful cat. You laugh so much, your sides will ache, your heart will go...
This is NPR News.
And you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us, and happy Thanksgiving. News headlines coming up next, and then a bit later this hour. It was Thanksgiving Day 40 years ago, when the rock group The Band said goodbye to fans in a now famous concert called The Last Waltz. David Green talks with guitarist Robbie Robertson. That's in 10 minutes on Morning Edition. Stay tuned.
WPR is sponsoring a Holiday Vacations cruise next September with Ann Strangehamps and Steve Paulson of To the Best of Our Knowledge, sailing around New England and down the St. Lawrence Seaway aboard the MS Rotterdam. It opens with a tour of Boston and dinner with Tom Ashbrook of On Point. The trip visits the ports of Bar Harbor, Halifax, Sydney, Charlottetown, Quebec City, and finishes in Montreal. More information on the trip is at wpr.org/travel.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A car bombing at a gas station in Iraq today has killed at least 21 people. It happened south of Baghdad near the city of Hilla. ISIS is claiming responsibility. Large crowds are lining the streets of New York City, where the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade is underway amid tight security. New York Police Commissioner James O'Neill says dozens of large vehicles are blocking intersections along the parade route as a precaution.
This year we have blocker trucks, we have 83 sand trucks, and we have 114 blocker vehicles to prevent any vehicles from coming on the route.
O'Neill was speaking to NBC's Today Show. He says there are no specific or credible threats against the parade. This is day two of a pilot strike at Lufthansa. As Esme Nicholson reports from Berlin, the German carrier has canceled hundreds of flights through tomorrow.
This latest strike has so far grounded over 1,800 flights, causing disruption to more than 200,000 Lufthansa customers and a cost of $21 million to the airline. It is the 14th time pilots have walked out since spring of 2014 and is the result of an ongoing dispute about pay and working conditions.
A federal judge in Ohio is ordering pilots back to work at the cargo airline ABX Air. About 250 pilots walked off the job on Tuesday in a dispute over time off and working conditions. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
And with Wisconsin Public Radio News, I'm Peter Bryant. Many people are giving thanks over a big meal this Thanksgiving. But as Daniel Kading reports, some food banks in Wisconsin are providing meals to those who are going without.
Executive Director Shay Morris with Second Harvest Northern Lakes Food Bank says demand is starting to level off, but she says a number of factors drive the need.
Home heating season, medication, utilities, those things can all drive people to really needing extra food assistance because the money is just not covering all of those expenses.
Charles McLymans agrees. He's president and CEO of Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin. He says demand has risen over the last 4 years despite more people finding work.
Many of them are part-time jobs or low-wage jobs. People simply don't have enough funds at the end of the month to get all the food that they need.
To meet growing demand, he says they opened a food bank in the Appleton area last year. They've provided about 20% more food since then. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The State Department of Transportation finished most of its planned road work ahead of the holiday weekend, but travelers may still see some delays on the roads. There are lane and ramp closures in some areas, including several near the Zoo Interchange in Milwaukee County. And in addition, the state's likely to see heavy traffic. AAA Wisconsin projects nearly a million residents traveling this holiday. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Tate's Bake Shop, whose founder Kathleen King started selling her handmade chocolate chip cookies from her dad's farm stand in the Hamptons as a child. Now at markets nationwide. Gift baskets are at tatesbakeshop.com. From LifeLock, reminding consumers that identity thieves don't take the holidays off. Increased online shopping during the holidays and use of public Wi-Fi could expose personal information. More at LifeLock.com. And from the Kresge Foundation at Kresge.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Some immigrants say they've been treated differently since the presidential election, and we're going to meet one of them. Tenzin Dorji is his name. He is a naturalized United States citizen. He runs a successful restaurant and also an arts festival in upstate New York. In his descriptions of harassment he's faced, you're going to hear language that some people will find offensive. North Country Public Radio's Zach Hirsch reports that Dorji's experience has triggered a powerful community response.
Tenzin Dorji grew up in Bhutan, and for the past 9 years, he's lived in Plattsburgh, New York, a tiny city near the U.S.-Canada border. Dorji said he's been singled out a few times over the years, but nothing like what he experienced the day after the election.
There's a couple of guys standing next to a couple of trucks, and you know that's when they say, "Hey, chink, get the F out of my country. Go back to where you came from." And I just smiled at them, and then it happened again.
Just a few steps away, he said two other people used the same racial slur. Later, he was out running errands when a car cut him off. Dorji said the driver flashed him the middle finger. A few days after that, Dorji's car was vandalized while it was parked outside his house. He was really shaken up.
I was just scared for my kids and my family.
On Facebook, he wrote a long, emotional post where he said he decided to become a gun owner.
The weapon of destruction is my only safeguard against the hate that has been directed against the color of my skin and political beliefs.
Being peaceful is a huge part of Dorji's identity. He's a practicing Buddhist, but he felt like he was out of options, so he planned to get a shotgun for the house and get a license to carry a pistol. He said it was a dark, low moment, but then he heard from friends.
I've had community members come up to me and say, "Tenzin, you know, we're behind you all the way."
The support kept pouring in. His phones have been off the hook, with people calling and messaging just to tell Dorji they've got his back. And at a local film festival, the MC, Michael Devine, surprised Dorji with an award just for being a good person.
Tenzin, who's here tonight with our first annual Mandala Award.
Dorji was stunned. He wiped away tears as the theater erupted into a standing ovation. Meanwhile, the family business, the Himalaya restaurant, has been packed lately. On a Tuesday night, almost every table was taken. At the bar, Catherine Eloranto was signing a giant card that said, "We are a nation of immigrants."
It's wonderful to see so many people coming out and supporting him.
Someone also wrote "Love Zone" in chalk on the sidewalk outside. Dorji said he felt overwhelmed and humbled by the community response. And now, the idea of getting a gun just seems stupid.
When I look at that kind of support, then I do not feel the need to bear any kind of firearms, because that is my firearm.
While Dorji has been embraced in a big way, some people in this part of upstate New York still resent immigrants. Just around the corner from the Himalaya restaurant, 27-year-old Wendell Davenport is standing by his pickup truck. He said his issue is with people who are undocumented. And he's been that guy who shouts down immigrants, saying things like, "Go back to your country," from his truck window.
I will not lie about that. I have done that because my old boss hired illegals and fired half of his crew, so I was one of the crew.
Davenport also said he doesn't like the idea of people moving to the U.S. only to send money back home. Dorji said even though he's a citizen, he's still afraid of getting harassed. But he's now convinced that, at least in this city, the people who believe in love and acceptance far outnumber those who are hateful. For NPR News, I'm Zach Hirsch in Plattsburgh, New York.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy Thanksgiving. Good to have you with us. And stay tuned. Some great music for your Thanksgiving holiday coming up. Stephanie Elkins joins us right after the newscast at 9. And this morning's music includes highlights from this year's Wisconsin School Music Association Honors Concerts, performances by middle and high school orchestras and choirs. That and much more coming up, but today all starting at 9 o'clock right after the news.
Support comes from Gateway. Lock in a job, learn a trade on site and in class, and get paid as you go. Apprenticeships are available in a growing variety of areas, including industrial manufacturing tech, machine repair, plumbing, and mechatronics. Call Nikki at 262-564-2952.
Run December 1st through the 11th. WPR is proud to promote live theater performance. For more information, go to wpr.org/events.
The Thanksgiving Day weather forecast, cloudy skies, high temperatures in the mid-30s to around 40. Parts of northwest and northeast Wisconsin might see some light snow and freezing drizzle. For tonight, cloudy skies, some light snow developing statewide, lows in the 20s.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Wisconsin Public Radio Association Endowment Fund, providing ongoing operating funds to help sustain the present and future operation of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support comes from Gateway. Attention employers, build your workforce by using Gateway's subsidized apprenticeship program. Martin Peterson, Studio 262 Hair Lounge, the Kenosha County Sheriff's Department, and many more already have. 564-2952.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. On Thanksgiving Day 40 years ago, some rock and roll fans in California were treated to a musical feast. They were at an old ice skating rink and music hall in San Francisco, the Winterland Ballroom, and a beloved band was saying goodbye.
I pulled into Nazareth, was feeling about half past dead.
The name of this band, as simple as it gets, The Band. They called their 1976 farewell concert The Last Waltz. The star cast who wanted to share this moment with them included Eric Clapton, Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan. Movie director Martin Scorsese captured the whole thing and later released it as a movie. Today, many look back on that night as a transitional moment in American music as the classic rock era began to fade.
We had to play 21 songs with other artists, going from Muddy Waters to Joni Mitchell. It was a feat. And we played this 5-hour concert, and we didn't make a mistake.
You put the load right on me.
That's The Band's guitarist, Robbie Robertson. He has written a new memoir, and he joined us to talk about the musical journey that brought him to that Thanksgiving night. The story begins in the early 60s. Robbie, a teenager from Canada, was recruited to play with a down-and-dirty American rockabilly band, Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks.
I walk 47 miles of barbed wire, use a cobra snake for a necktie. Got a brand new...
It was probably the most exciting and almost violent rock and roll. It was fast and swift, and he was growling and romping around the stage like this uncaged animal.
Amid all this, Robbie met someone he would build a career with, the Hawks drummer, a slightly older guy named Levon Helm.
The way that he could play, the way he could sing, his personality, we formed a real brotherhood. And then it was Levon and I that were choosing the other guys. All the people from the South ended up leaving, and we were gathering more and more Canadians.
And this odd collection of mostly Canadian rockabilly players would end up leaving Ronnie Hawkins behind. They found temporary work with a new frontman, a guy named Bob Dylan. Maybe not at the perfect moment, Dylan was trying out a new electric rock sound, and his folk fans were not pleased.
So you can imagine going from city to city, setting up, playing a concert, the people boo you. You put your equipment away, you go on to the next town, you set up, people boo you, and you go on. And you just keep doing this. It isn't getting better, it's getting worse. And you can't help but think to yourself, what a strange way to make a buck.
Now, everyone referred to Robbie and his crew as the band playing with Bob Dylan. So when it came time to choose their own name, they went with the band. They holed up in this unassuming pink house in upstate New York to play and record.
I had this yearning to find a clubhouse, a workshop place where we could make music, never disturb anybody, very isolated, and we found it in Big Pink.
Well, and this is the time that you write about when some of the trouble started. I mean, drugs, alcohol, car accidents. I mean, how bad did things get?
You know, at the time, it just seemed kind of crazy. We were all very young, and I don't know, it became habitual, just crashing these cars. Between Richard Manuel and Rick Danko, we were,
putting away those rented cars
pretty regularly.
Oh, God.
And
sounds dangerous.
It was dangerous, but, you know, at a certain age, you don't see danger in the same kind of way. Over time, things evolved to a darker place.
So was it really affecting your music, too, in the creative process?
It affects everything. First, it was the only time, really, that I had a really bad feeling with Levon. Heroin will make you lie. And he did, and it really bothered me.
What did he lie about?
He lied about using heroin.
So you guys are putting out these successful albums while you're also watching your friend struggle with drugs and seeing drugs throughout the band. I mean, what? Take me to the decision to call it quits that will bring us to, you know, what's become known as the last waltz.
Well, this is a progressive disease. And I thought, we got to deal with this, and we got to get out of the way to deal with it. So we came up with the idea of the last waltz. And it started out that we were just going to invite Ronnie Hawkins and Bob Dylan because they had played such pivotal parts in our...
Which alone would have been special. Then the roster of guests kept expanding, it sounds like.
Somebody said, well, we can't do this and not invite Eric Clapton. And then someone else would say, well, if you're going to invite Eric, you got to invite Van Morrison. Come on.
Of course, you know? Of course.
And so it just kept going and going, and it turned into something special, and it felt beautiful at the time.
And your audience was coming. I mean, they were giving up their holiday, and you fed them turkey because it was Thanksgiving, right?
It was Bill Graham's idea. He said, we are going to serve Thanksgiving dinner to 5,000 people.
Oh, he was the promoter at the venue, Winterland, right?
Yeah. And we're going to have a waltz orchestra playing while they dine.
That Thanksgiving gathering in 1976 became more of a farewell than people thought. Robbie Robertson had planned for this to just be the end of touring. He was disappointed when he tried to get the band together a few days later.
We set up a time at the studio, and I think, well, the guys are running on rock and roll time. They're running a little behind.
Mm-hmm.
And I was waiting and waiting. And finally, I realized they weren't going to show up. It really made me feel bad. And I thought, I've got to read the writing on the wall here.
Robbie Robertson and the band would never get back together as a group after that Thanksgiving 40 years ago. And all those rock stars on stage, without saying it, were in a way saying goodbye as well, as the music of the 60s and 70s began to give way to newer sounds. On this Thanksgiving, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. And you heard Morning Edition on WPR this Thanksgiving morning. Just ahead, there's a little more news in the form of headlines. We'll bring you those on the hour today. And you can find more stories and our holiday schedules at WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Alumni Association, dedicated to providing student aid and attracting new scholars through the University of Wisconsin's annual campaign. More at supportuw.org.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.